Puerto Rico's culture and stories are brought to life in the poetry, fiction, and essays of the late Judith Ortiz Cofer, whose numerous books and teachings have inspired many, including former student and fellow Latina writer Lorraine Lopez.
Judith is gone, but her work is still here, and it's still vital and gripping and very, very important.
We'll hear more from Lorraine Lopez, who's co-edited a special journal that focuses on the late writer's work, after we listen to the second half of an archive conversation with Judith Ortiz Cofer. She discusses the politics of Puerto Rico and its U.S. history and reads from her books Reaching for the Mainland and The Latin Deli. This is New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. When we first scheduled this past American Voices episode, as part of our 40th anniversary of broadcasting, we wanted to honor this late Latina pioneer as part of National Hispanic Heritage Month because her views on her birthplace, Puerto Rico, are still relevant. Plus, 2017 happens to be the 100th anniversary of U.S. citizenship for the islanders, who came under this country's control after the Spanish-American War ended 400 years of Spanish colonial rule. With Puerto Rico's bankruptcy declaration in May and the half-hearted June vote for statehood, followed by the unforeseen devastation of Hurricane Maria in September, the insights of this poet, essayist, and fiction writer are even more poignant. The first half of our conversation, which you can hear on our website, newletters.org, reveals her family's story and how she became an esteemed professor at the University of Georgia before her death at age 64 from cancer in December 2016. Part two of our interview, recorded while she was a guest of Rockhurst University's 1998 Midwest Poet Series, focuses more on politics because that was another year the Puerto Ricans were voting on their future. Here's the late Judith Ortiz Cofer.
We're in a completely different position than other Latinos in that we are American citizens by documentation, which means that we don't have a sense of having given up our country when we come to the U.S. I go to Puerto Rico two or three times a year indefinitely. Every time I get time off from school, I go and spend as much time as possible there. That's where my mother and my whole maternal side of the family are. And all it takes is for me to drive to Atlanta, get on a plane, and 3 hours later, I'm in a completely different world, but still in the U.S. I don't have to apply for visas, don't have to worry about losing my rights. It is a matter of pride with us that we can always go back to our country. You know, the misfortune of the other immigrants is that once they make a commitment to this country is that they really do have to decide how much of their culture they're going to keep because they could go back for a vacation or whatever, but their lives are made here. They give up their citizenship in another country and come here. We don't feel that we have to do that. And so to give that up is to give up what makes us, I think, privileged in this country. I say privileged and I can already hear the criticisms because privileged in that we can go back home, but not privileged in the fact that in actuality, our citizenship is not first class. It's not exactly the same. Whatever the documents say, Puerto Ricans are, in almost every situation, treated as if we were immigrants in this country.
Even though I know somewhat about the history, I hadn't even really thought about that. But you're right. That is exactly how, for the most part, we view anyone moving from another place. Because when I was reading The Latin Deli, for instance, I had the sense of it being sort of immigrant nonfiction, not that they're already part of the country. They're just not on the mainland.
Well, we identifiably from, you know, people not from your neighborhood in the sense that we look different, we talk different, and our culture is different. But what is difficult for Puerto Ricans to accept is not so much the personal as the other that keeps us, for example, in a job from being treated any differently than anyone who is not an American citizen. For example, discrimination in housing and that sort of thing. It's never right, but it is doubly ironic when you are assured that as a citizen from birth of the United States, that you don't have to be proving every time that you deserve any privilege normally and naturally given to any other citizen. And that's why they consider themselves, you know, second-class citizens, mm-hmm. because the treatment is that. And many people who want statehood feel that that can somehow be legislated, that once Puerto Rico becomes a state, that our situation will be better. And I don't know whether that can be legislated because of the matter of color and culture and language. Mm-hmm. I have grown up hearing passionate speeches in favor of all three positions. In my mother's own family, there are 8 brothers and sisters, and the 3 parties are represented: pro-statehood, pro-independence, and pro-commonwealth. And I have heard my uncles and aunts talk endlessly about the benefits of each and the dangers of the others. And so I am not going to risk giving my opinion in that sense, in that, first of all, although I want the best for the island, I no longer live there all the time. So it is not up to me to decide what is the best for the island. I do know one thing for sure, though, and that is that anything that threatens the language and culture of the island is going to cause tremendous unhappiness. Puerto Rico is not just a territory that can be just supplanted with new customs. It is a deeply Latino culture. The language is deeply embedded. The culture, as a Spanish-speaking country, has been there since the colonial times. And what all of them are afraid of is that we will lose that. Mm. And so whatever happens, I think some kind of compromise is going to have to be reached.
The culture is such a strong part of the island.
Yes.
And it hangs on with people who even move from the island to the mainland,
yes,
to
does.
The United States. And that's what you capture so well in your writing, I think.
Well, thank you. Our position, isolated from the mainland, makes us different from, say, you know, the territories of the Southwest, like during the Mexican situation, where people could drift in and slowly change things. That's not likely to happen in Puerto Rico. The experiment about all English was tried once before during my parents' generation, before we had our own governor. The American governors at one point decided that all classroom teaching would be in English. And I have an essay about that in my book, Silent Dancing, where my father talks about being forced to shed his Puerto Rican identity and language at the door of the classroom. The teachers taught by rote, and the minute that everyone left the classroom, they went back to Spanish. And by passive resistance, they defeated that. I think that most Puerto Ricans will want to keep their language and culture. And how that can be worked out and work out a different political situation than what we have now, I don't know. That's what's going to be interesting to watch that develop.
You're listening to the late writer Judith Ortiz Cofer, who shares some of her poetry ahead in this conversation about her birthplace, the U.S. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, on this special Past American Voices episode of New Letters on the Air.
There is a wonderful documentary film called My Puerto Rico, by a filmmaker named Raquel Ortiz, no relation. And it talks about the 500 years of Puerto Rican history. And if you watch that film, you will see that this is something we have been discussing. I should say we, but it's actually the island Puerto Ricans who are so deeply involved in determining their fate, something that has never stopped being discussed. And I don't claim to be an expert or to even know what is going to be determined. All I know is that it has been sort of in a state of limbo for long enough, and the people want to speak their minds as to what they want to be.
Yeah, and have a say in deciding.
And have a say in it, yeah. And it's not so much a rejection of anything as just that the island has earned the right to say what it wants.
You know, I was struck by one of your poems in Reaching for the Mainland, mm-hmm. about this division between two cultures, mm-hmm. and it's called The Other. Mm-hmm. I like that one because it kind of captures that duality, mm-hmm. that you deal with so much in your life and in your writing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's both personal and political. I was telling a class that, you know, your body is your vehicle. And just like if you drive in front of a place in a wrecked car, people immediately judge you. If you drive up in a Mercedes, they also judge you in a different way because different vehicles, you know, represent different ways of identifying someone as either valuable or not valuable. And so in this poem, I deal with the fact that, you know, what my personality may have developed to be, I have chosen to live in a place where I'm judged by different standards, you know. And so there is a duality in my person and in the choices I make on a daily basis. And of course, also politically, I have chosen to live in this country. And therefore, I am no longer the kind of Puerto Rican that my mother is. Her destiny and her island's destiny are one. It is as if the island were her body. Hmm. You know, and with me, it's a matter of the heart.
I was wondering if you'd read that for us.
Yes, of course. The other. A slow-eyed dark woman shadows me. In the morning, she sings Spanish love songs in a high falsetto, filling my shower stall with echoes. She is by my side in front of the mirror as I slip into my tailored skirt and she into her red cotton dress. She shakes out her black mane as I run a comb through my closely cropped cap. Her mouth is like a red bull's eye, daring me. Everywhere I go, I must make room for her. She crowds me in elevators where others wonder at all the space I need. At night, her weight tips my bed, and it is her wild dreams that run rampant through my head, exhausting me. Her heart beats like dozens of spiders carrying the poison of her restlessness, drag their countless legs over my bare flesh.
The Other, from Reaching for the Mainland and Selected New Poems by the late Judith Ortiz Cofer, published in 1995, the year her young adult novel, An Island Like You, Stories of the Barrio, came out, which won the Por Belpre Award from the American Library Association. Inspired by her childhood when her father joined the military and moved his family from rural Puerto Rico to urban Paterson, New Jersey, the young Latina was introduced to a new language and the complexity of race in America.
Paterson was changing during the 60s, I'm talking about. Its population was shifting. You know, the whites were moving to the suburbs and the blacks and the Puerto Ricans were moving into the city. And when I was in school, of course, there was the discrimination of many Puerto Ricans were put into special classes because they thought that because we didn't speak English perfectly, it was some kind of learning disability. But once we did learn the language, then I started noticing that the blacks had an even more difficult time. They were not even judged by their language. It was just, you're black, therefore, you know, you're going to be placed in this situation. And children live up to the expectations of their teachers and other adults. Mm-hmm. We learn to see ourselves the way they see us, you know. And so I understood that prejudice came in many forms, but mainly it has to do with what I called the law of the jungle. You know, the idea that if someone doesn't look like they belong to your tribe, then you have to do something about excluding them. You know, and of course, we are dark skinned, but we're not black. And so the blacks are further removed from white society by their bodies. By something as personal as skin color, you know.
You deal with that in one of the essays in The Latin Deli, where you're talking about feeling the sort of discrimination about being Puerto Rican, and then also dealing with this girl in your class who is black and recognizing the discrimination that she went through all, and that being Puerto Rican was one step above being black somehow.
To the teacher. That's in an essay called The Paterson Public Library. And so that's baffling to any intelligent person to really think about, that we do exactly like I was telling this class, what my cat does. If it's not a cat that he's familiar with or one of us, he goes into panic. And it can be a bunny rabbit or it can be, you know, a stuffed animal, whatever, anything that doesn't look like him. And it goes for my cat and it goes for the lion in the jungle. And unfortunately, it goes for us. And what we hope is that we become educated enough to get past that idea that we're separated by something as superficial, you know, as skin color, but I certainly saw it in action all of my life. The darker you were, the fewer privileges you got.
Yeah.
It happens even within the own ethnic groups and cultures. There's so much to learn, and that's why I tell my students that it's so important to read, you know, Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and even Terry McMillan and the Latino writers and all that, because I'm teaching women in literature, and I'm having them read about women and their bodies in different cultures and how they grow up thinking of themselves. And, you know, my Anglo students, my white students are surprised, you know, at how the cultures lead a girl to perceive herself beautiful or not. And sometimes the standards are completely different from one culture to the other. Or what's a good girl and what's a bad girl, you know. And each culture, you know, determines that for each person. And then beyond that, you also have to fight the mainstream culture. And no wonder there are so many confused people out there. And prejudice is just a really easy way to defend yourself against anything that might be mysterious or unknown. If you just refuse to associate with anyone or anything that's different from you, then you're safer than if you risk it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sounding like I'm a big political writer, and actually my work, it deals with human emotions and families, and I think that the politics are in the living, not on a soapbox or,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I think your work definitely deals with relationships. Going back to that particular essay about the Patterson Public Library,
yeah,
I was really taken by the way it deals with some of these racial issues, but it also deals with writing,
mm-hmm,
and what, in a way, was your doorway into,
right,
the literary world. And
mm-hmm,
I really like that. So I was wondering if you could read the last part of it.
Actually, this was something I wrote remembering how I came to love literature. And it was at a time when the world seemed chaotic and the only refuge was the Patterson Public Library. And I used to go there with great excitement. It was the way I absorbed fantasy in those days that gave me the sense of inner freedom, a feeling of power, and the ability to fly that is the main reward of the writer. As I read those stories, I became not only the characters but their creator. I am still fascinated by the idea that fairy tales and fables are part of humankind's collective unconscious, a familiar theory that acquires concreteness in my own writing today, when I discover over and over that the character I create or the themes that recur in my poems and in my fiction are my own versions of the types I learned to recognize very early in my life in fairy tales. There was also violence in these stories, villains decapitated in honorable battle, goblins and witches pursued, beaten, and burned at the stake by heroes with magic weapons, possessing the supernatural strength granted to the self-righteous in folklore. I understood those black and white duels between evil and justice. But Lorraine's blind hatred of my person and my knee-liquefying fear of her were not so clear to me at that time. It would be many years before I learned about the politics of race, before I internalized the awful reality of the struggle for territory that underscored the lives of blacks and Puerto Ricans in Patterson during my childhood. Each job given to a light-skinned Hispanic was one less job for a black man. Every apartment leased to a Puerto Rican family was one less place available to blacks. Worst of all, though the Puerto Rican children had to master a new language in the schools and were often subjected to the scorn and impatience of teachers, burdened with too many students making too many demands in a classroom, the blacks were obviously the ones singled out for special treatment. In other words, whenever possible, they were assigned to special education classes in order to relieve the teacher's workload, mainly because their black English dialect sounded ungrammatical and illiterate to our white Seton Hall University and City College educated instructors. I have on occasion become angry at being treated like I'm mentally deficient by persons who make that prejudgment upon hearing an unfamiliar accent. I can only imagine what it must have been like for children like Lorraine, whose skin color alone put her in a pigeonhole she felt she had to fight her way out of every day of her life. I was one of the lucky ones. As an insatiable reader, I quickly became more than adept at the use of the English language. My life as a Navy brat, moving with my family from Patterson to Puerto Rico every few months, as my father's tours of duty demanded, taught me to depend on knowledge as my main source of security. What I learned from books borrowed from the Greek temple among the ruins of the city, I carried with me as the lightest of carry-on luggage. My teachers in both countries treated me well in general. The easiest way to become a teacher's pet or la favorita is to ask the teacher for books to read, and I was always looking for reading material. Even my mother's romantic novels by Corinne Tellado and her Buen Hogar, Spanish Good Housekeeping magazine, were not safe from my insatiable word hunger. Since the days when I was stalked by Lorraine, libraries have always been an adventure for me. Fear of an ambush is no longer the reason why I feel my pulse quicken a little when I approach a library building, when I enter the stacks and inhale the familiar smell of old leather and paper. It may be the memory of the danger that heightens my senses, but it is really the expectation that I felt and that I still feel now about books. They contain most of the information I needed to survive in two languages and in two worlds. When adults were too busy to answer my endless questions, I could always look it up. When I felt unbearably lonely, as I often did during those early gypsy years traveling with my family, I read to escape and also to connect. You can come back to a book as you cannot always to a person or place you miss. I read and reread favorite books until the characters seemed like relatives or friends I could see when I wanted or needed to see them. I still feel that way about books. They represent my spiritual life. A library is my sanctuary, and I'm always at home in one.
That was just part of the essay, The Patterson Public Library, from the Latin Deli, Telling the Lives of Barrio Women, winner of the 1994 Annis Field Wolf Award. You can hear more from this book, reissued in 2010 by the University of Georgia Press, in the first half of this 1998 conversation with the late Judith Ortiz Cofer at newletters.org, where we also have more of this particular essay in an anthology program about libraries called American Sanctuaries. We finish out this special Past American Voices episode with another award-winning Latina writer, Lorraine Lopez. We called the Vanderbilt University professor by Skype just before she left to lecture in Germany. The author of six books of fiction talks about her former professor, Judith Ortiz Cofer.
She was my dissertation director, so she was the one who shepherded me through the doctoral program at the University of Georgia, and I loved her work and I wanted to work with her. She and I happened to be around the same age. I believe we are only about 4 or 5 years apart, and we developed a different kind of relationship than I think professors usually have with students who are a couple of generations or a generation removed. We were closer to being peers in age. So over time, our relationship shifted to friendship, and we developed a very strong bond with one another, just as women of the same age who are in the same kind of circumstances from similar backgrounds and a similar culture.
And so did you trade your work back and forth frequently, even after you graduated?
We did, and she was always a very generous reader of my work, and I too read her work in draft form and gave what feedback I could on it. And, you know, of course, it's very intimidating to give this canonical author feedback, but I like to think that it helped her to be able to talk about her work with someone who had read it before it was published so that she could continue to consider it and develop it. Yes, we continued to exchange work, but moreover, we exchanged news of the day and what we were going through and some of our struggles in the academy, as well as family news, what was going on with our children and then our grandchildren. Those were the kind of things that we shared.
That sounds like her in her writing, too, because even though it had all this cultural impact, it was so much about family relationships. I'm so glad she's not around to see the devastation in Puerto Rico. I think that would be devastating to her as well on such a personal level.
Oh, I think so, too. In her last book, The Cruel Country, that is a nonfiction memoir about her mother's death. Her mother lived on the island, and in it, there are a couple of recollections of preparing for storms and worry about her mother during storms. And I think that if her mother were alive and if Judith had lived, I think that would have been extremely stressful and tragic for her, as it is for the people I know now, like Rafael Ocasio, who co-edited the journal with me, memorializing Judith. His family is in Puerto Rico, and he's going back this week. And he's extremely distraught by what's happened there and just overcome with worry because he can't know what's going on with his family right now.
Right. Everybody is so out of touch. This issue that you mentioned is of the South Atlantic Review, and it's forthcoming in November 2017, and it's dedicated to Judith. Can you give me a quick idea of what all will be in that journal?
Rafael and I co-edited the journal, and we structured it in two parts. One part contains critical articles on her work, and the other part contains what we call testimonials, and these are remembrances of Judith by academics and by authors that are more personal. And that's the section that I edited, and Rafa was in charge of the critical pieces. And he, in fact, wrote a really marvelous overview of Judith's work and life that appears at the beginning of that section. But we have testimonials from authors, including Julia Alvarez, Rigoberto Gonzalez. I have a testimonial in there. Judith's colleagues from the University of Georgia, the president of the University of Georgia wrote a really beautiful memory of her. And the critical articles are insightful, and they bring her work to life in vital ways.
So anyone who wants to know more about Judith Ortiz Cofer can order an issue of the South Atlantic Review coming out in November, and I think it's going to be presented at the conference.
The South Atlantic Modern Language Association, SAMLA conference in Atlanta, Georgia.
Now, you yourself have also written a critical book about Judith Ortiz Cofer, right?
I edited that work, and I did write the introductory essay, but it is a collection of essays by scholars and academics on Judith's work, this entirely critical articles.
And it's called Rituals of Movement in the Writing of Judith Ortiz Cofer.
And it's out from Caribbean Studies Press. It's another, you know, labor of love that I co-edited actually with Margaret Crumpton Winter, who was also Judith's student.
That's really neat. Well, Lorraine, I know you're on a short schedule because you got to fly out to Germany right now. So I wanted to see if there was anything else you want to add about Judith.
I want to encourage everyone who hears this broadcast to get to a library or a bookstore and pick up a book by Judith, and you will grow and you will be amazed from the experience of her words. I guarantee that.
Lorraine Lopez, co-editor of the special November 2017 issue of South Atlantic Review that focuses on the work and influence of the late Judith Ortiz Cofer, who died December 30th, 2016. For links and to hear more on her life in part one of this archive interview, visit newletters.org. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, this interview was originally produced with Margaret Smith and Laura Spencer and made into our Past American Voices series with Claire Verbeck and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.